content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 13th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Netanyahu challenges Obama on Iran. What happened? Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu issued an audacious warning to President Obama this week over the nuclear deal being negotiated with Iran, telling a joint session of Congress that the emerging agreement would all but guarantee that Tehran obtain the bomb. In an impassioned 40-minute address, Netanyahu declared that the very bad deal, which could keep Iran's breakout time to develop nuclear weapons at a year, but expire in as little as a decade, would ultimately set off nuclear arms race in the Middle East and threaten the survival of Israel. Netanyahu's speech, which was organized by Republican House Speaker John Boehner without consultation of the White House, was boycotted by about 50 Democrats. Vice President Joe Biden did not attend because he was out of the country. Obama also declined to attend, saying he couldn't be seen taking sides ahead of Israel's March 17th election. Republican Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced he would fast-track a bipartisan bill to impose congressional oversight of the deal, prompting Democrats to withdraw their support for the legislation. Meanwhile, the negotiations between Iran and the so-called P5 plus 1, the U.S., U.K., France, Russia, China, and Germany, continued ahead of the March 24th deadline for a framework agreement. "We have made some progress," a State Department official said, "but we have a lot of challenges ahead." What the editorial said: "Ignore the thunderous applause and fawning lawmakers in Congress," said the New York Times. "With no new insight on Iran and no reasons to reject the agreement, Netanyahu's speech was essentially just a campaign ad for his upcoming election back home. Obama has repeatedly pledged not to let Iran obtain a nuclear weapon and to take action if Tehran breaks the terms of any deal. If Netanyahu values the U.S.-Israel alliance so much, he should put more trust in our president." "What has Obama done to earn the benefit of the doubt?" said the New York Post. "This is the commander-in-chief who dismissed ISIS as a JV team and who lauded the counterterrorism success story of Yemen only months before the U.S. had to abandon its embassy there. The Israeli prime minister knew he couldn't convince our pushover president of the need to drive a harder bargain," said the Wall Street Journal. "But by making this high-profile speech in Congress, he has shown a spotlight on an accord that has been negotiated in secret and which Obama wants Americans to accept without a vote in Congress. Maybe now we'll have a debate worthy of the high nuclear stakes." What the columnist said: "For all the Democrats moaning, it's Obama who's injecting partisanship into this issue," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. "His administration eagerly seized on Netanyahu's supposed diplomatic snub as a way to divert attention from the astonishing concessions being offered to Iran. But by turning the speech into a cause célèbre, Obama actually gave Netanyahu's triumph in Congress more publicity than it otherwise would have received." "Bibi has nothing useful to say," said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. "He made it clear he opposes any deal that falls short of Iran's total disarmament and regime change, which the mullahs are never going to agree to. Netanyahu was essentially agitating for war. His real focus isn't Iran anyway, said Gershom Gorenberg in Prospect.org. It's the election. Israelis are much more concerned about out-of-control housing prices than existential nuclear threats. With voters increasingly blaming Netanyahu for the housing crisis, he is desperate to get the campaign conversation back to Iran. Netanyahu is playing a dangerous game, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. Unlike most alliances, the close relationship between Israel and the U.S. isn't based on self-interest. It's about warmth, emotion, and shared values. But thanks to Bibi, these ties are eroding. First, he putatively backed Mitt Romney in 2012. Now he has colluded in a partisan effort to embarrass the president. Making Israel a left-right issue in the U.S. would be a great mistake. With an indifferent America, Israel would become a lonely, frightening place. And we have a second main story this week. Obamacare back in court. The Supreme Court appeared sharply divided over a centerpiece of President Obama's health care law during oral arguments this week, leaving the outcome of a Republican-backed challenge to the Affordable Care Act too close to call. The case focuses on a provision in the law that declares federal subsidies can be awarded only to people who buy health insurance through exchanges established by the state. Lawyers for the plaintiffs argued that federal tax credits could therefore not be offered in the 34 states that punted the task of providing insurance to the federalhealthcare.gov website. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia agreed, saying the provision means what it says. The Obama administration dismissed the clause's wording as a typo and said the law would never have been financially viable without nationwide subsidies. The court's four liberal justices support that position, but would need the votes of either Chief Justice John Roberts or Justice Anthony Kennedy to prevail. Roberts remained largely silent during the arguments. Kennedy said the provision's wording was unambiguous, but that a literal reading could push Obamacare into a death spiral. The early signs say Obamacare will survive, said Jay Michelson in thedailybeast.com. As Justice Breyer pointed out, allowing one four-word provision to gut an entire 828-page bill is like forcing an elephant into a mouse hole. The court must recognize that Democratic lawmakers would never have passed Obamacare if they knew it contained a self-destruct clause. But as Kennedy acknowledged, the provision's wording is really, really clear, said Jonathan Keim in NationalReview.com. So the question now is, who gets to fix this broken law? The legislative power belongs to Congress alone, not to a president who believes he has the divine authority to reinterpret laws at will in a complete defiance of the Constitution's separation of powers. Republicans should be careful what they wish for, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. If the justices rule against the government and strip 11.5 million mostly middle-class Americans of their affordable insurance, the blame would fall squarely on the GOP. Moreover, private polling from a conservative group found that huge majorities would want Congress to restore subsidies. The GOP would soon regret the day they ever decided to take Obamacare to court. The controversy of the week. Iran. Is Obama's nuclear deal too generous? House Speaker John Boehner may have issued the invitation, said Mario Loyola in NationalReview.com. But it was President Obama who really brought Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Washington this week. The president has negotiated a toothless nuclear deal with Iran that he knows Israel can't live with. According to leaked reports, the proposed deal would leave Iran's nuclear infrastructure mostly intact, including heavy water reactors and at least 6,000 centrifuges, and even allow work to continue on a ballistic missile program. Worst of all, the deal is designed to sunset after 10 to 15 years, whereupon Iran could pursue its nuclear ambitions out in the open. What does the West get for these stunning concessions, said Chris Stewart in the Wall Street Journal? Essentially nothing. We'd lift sanctions on Iran, and the regime would allow inspections of its nuclear facilities, and it's supposed to be doing already. Iran has a long history of deception about its nuclear program, and the International Atomic Energy Agency complained only last month that Tehran is stonewalling its inspectors. A shrewder president than ours would walk away from this terrible deal. Barack Obama, tragically, seems intent on doing the opposite. What choice do we have? Said Paul Pillar in Reuters.com. If the U.S. rejects the proposed deal, as Netanyahu wants Congress to do, Iran will simply pursue a nuclear program unrestricted and unmonitored. The only other option is military action, said Robert Einhorn in NYTimes.com, and it's a bad one. As well as starting another costly and unpredictable war in the Middle East, a military strike would set back Iran's nuclear program by only a few years and would likely trigger an Iranian decision to go for nuclear weapons as quickly as possible. At least the deal now on the table would keep Iran's breakout time, how long it would take to build a single bomb, to a full year. That's more than enough time to exhaust diplomatic efforts and economic pressures before turning, if necessary, to military force. True, there are no good options, said Charles Krauthammer in WashingtonPost.com. But Obama's prospective deal is the worst possible. This is Iran we're talking about, the most rogue of rogue regimes. This deal would explicitly allow Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and his mullahs to build an industrial-strength, internationally sanctioned nuclear program once the ludicrous sunset period expires. We can surely do better than this, and war is not the only alternative. Economic sanctions brought Iran to the negotiating table in the first place. A round of tougher sanctions can now produce a better deal, perhaps one that incorporates Netanyahu's suggestion that restrictions remain in place for as long as Iran continues its aggression in the region and in the world. More sanctions wouldn't work, said Eugene Robinson in WashingtonPost.com. At least not without the participation of Iran's allies, Russia and China. And right now, that seems unlikely. The best option the U.S. has is to strike a deal with Iran or at least allow inspections, knowing that the alternatives, sanctions and war, are still there if the deal breaks down. That must be what Obama is thinking, said Jeffrey Goldberg in TheAtlantic.com. But it's always a bad idea to walk into a car dealership and announce, I'm going to buy this car no matter what. From what we're hearing, it sounds like Obama's negotiators may have done exactly that. Well, it was a good week for self-determination. After a Massachusetts police reported a spate of dogs using large snowbanks to escape yards and go exploring. If you've got a dog that's inquisitive, said a police spokesman, it's going to look for something. It was a good week for trade-ins. After an Italian neurosurgeon claimed he would be able to transplant a living human head onto a donor body within 2 years. If society doesn't want it, I won't do it, Dr. Sergio Canavero said. Before going to the moon, you want to make sure people will follow you. It was a good week for artistic license. After the artist who painted Bill Clinton's official presidential portrait revealed that he included a shadow of a blue dress as a bit of a metaphor on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. It was a bad week for sharing the wealth. after Republican presidential hopeful Jeb Bush asked donors to contribute no more than $1 million to his campaign this quarter. Bush needs substantial funds, said a fundraiser, but doesn't want the focus to be on money. It was a bad week for cheering on the home team after Representative Eric Schock, Republican from Illinois, was found to have spent $1,200 of public money on a private plane ticket to see a Chicago Bears game, just 1 month after he repaid taxpayers for using congressional funds to redecorate his Capitol office in the style of Downton Abbey. It was a bad week for getting hopped up after a DEA agent told Utah lawmakers that legalizing the cultivation of marijuana in the state could lead wild rabbits to get high on it and lose their natural instincts. Turn now to the briefing page. The Koch brothers' agenda. Libertarians Charles and Donald Koch want to raise $890 million for the 2016 election. Why do Democrats hate them? Who are the Koch brothers? Possibly the most influential non-elected individuals in American politics. Through their vast network of political action committees and advocacy groups, the billionaire industrialists have raised hundreds of millions of dollars to influence legislation and elect conservative politicians who share their aims of cutting regulation, taxes, and government spending. Charles and David Koch's 17 largest groups spent $400 million in the 2012 election and about $300 million in last year's midterms, financing grassroots campaigns, election analytics, and a barrage of attack ads. Most of this is dark money, which, because of a loophole in campaign finance law, can be donated anonymously. And thanks to several U.S. Supreme Court decisions, corporations and rich donors can give unlimited amounts to outside organizations like the Kochs. The Koch, it's K-O-C-H, but pronounced Koch, brothers plan to pump even more cash into the 2016 presidential campaign. Their $889 million fundraising target, much of which would come from a network of 300 super wealthy donors, is expected to exceed what either the Republican or Democratic parties will raise and spend. It's no wonder Republican candidates show up when the Koch brothers call, said David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama. In many ways, they have superseded the party. How did they make their money? In 1967, Charles took over the oil refinery business that his father had built from scratch. Renaming it Koch Industries, he and younger brother David expanded the Kansas-based firm into global petroleum, plastics, and chemicals conglomerate. With annual revenues of $115 billion, Koch Industries is now one of America's largestly privately owned companies, responsible for products as diverse as Stainmaster carpets and Lycra spandex. Charles, 79, and David, 74, are tied for sixth on Forbes' ranking of the world's wealthiest people, worth about $42 billion each. But their success came at a high personal cost. Their two siblings, older brother Fred and David's twin Bill, tried to wrest control of Koch Industries in the 1980s. Charles and David bought out their brothers for $1.1 billion, but the scars from the fight remain. In a 2012 interview, Charles referred to Bill only as the brother of the twin. What are the Koch's politics? They're essentially libertarians. They support gay marriage and the legalization of marijuana, but they champion free market principles and are economically very conservative. They oppose the Affordable Care Act, food stamps, and the minimum wage. David ran as the Libertarian Party's vice presidential candidate in 1980, but the brothers abandoned the party when they realized it would never challenge Washington's political duopoly. The Kochs own the Cato Institute, a prominent libertarian think tank, and their groups helped bankroll candidates involved in the Tea Party wave in 2010 and the GOP Senate takeover last year. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid has repeatedly denounced the brothers for trying to buy America, quipping that Republicans are addicted to Coke. Why else are the Democrats angry? Because most of the Koch's political network, dubbed as Kochtopus, is deliberately so opaque. Its main funding arm, Freedom Partners, raised $256 million in 2012, but because it's organized as a social welfare group, whose primary purpose is supposedly educational rather than political, its donors are exempt from public disclosure requirements. Liberals are also infuriated by the brothers' opposition to environmental legislation. It recently emerged they were one of the energy industry groups funding the research of astrophysicist Y. Hawk Soon, an influential climate change skeptic. Senator Bernie Sanders, a liberal Vermont independent, claims the brothers oppose every law that protects the middle class, the elderly, the children, the sick, and the most vulnerable. How do the Kochs respond? By pointing out that their fundraising is legal and claiming donor anonymity is necessary to protect against the threat of retaliation by liberal attack groups. The Kochs also accuse liberals of double standards. Democrats also benefit from dark money, albeit on a much smaller scale, and had their own billionaire bankrollers, such as financier George Soros and environmentalist Tom Steyer. So far, Democratic attack ads linking Republican candidates to the Kochs have not been effective with voters. Anytime my candidate is talking about the voters' money and my opponent is talking about other people's money, says Republican strategist Brad Todd, I feel pretty good about our chances. Who will they back in 2016? The Kochs probably won't support a specific GOP primary candidate. Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz all attended the brothers' recent semi-annual fundraising weekend. The brothers will likely support whoever wins the Republican nomination and back selected candidates who they believe will further their goals in Congress. Their network has already become a shadow version of the GOP, with campaign strategists targeting specific demographic groups, and its influence will stretch beyond 2016. We are genuinely a long-term effort, explains Tim Phillips, president of the Koch-backed Americans for Prosperity. We're not about some election cycle. The liberal answer to the Kochs. If the Kochs are the left's boogeyman, then the right has its own billionaire villain in environmentalist Tom Steyer. A former hedge fund manager, Steyer gave $74 million to Democrats in last year's midterms, making him the largest individual donor on either side. In publicly disclosed donations, at least. Conservatives have claimed that Steyer's generous donations have influenced President Obama's energy policy. But Steyer insists that comparisons with the Kochs are unfair. He's worth $1.6 billion to their combined $84 billion and declares all his donations and donors' identities. The Californian also argues that although his donations are ideologically motivated, the Koch brothers push policies that will aid their business interests. This defense doesn't wash with conservatives or many liberals. Democrats can't claim that their billionaires are pure at heart, said Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute, while conservative billionaires only have selfish motives. Take a look now at some of the best columns. Two from the U.S. this week, from Jennifer Rubin at thewashingtonpost.com. Walker's foreign policy deficit. Scott Walker has a problem, said Jennifer Rubin. The Wisconsin governor is leading polls for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, but there are increasing doubts about how much he knows beyond state issues. At last week's CPAC summit, Walker suggested that his experience battling Wisconsin unions would help him to fight the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria if elected president. 2 days later, he said the most important foreign policy decision of his lifetime was President Reagan's mass firing of striking air traffic controllers in 1981, arguing it sent a message to the USSR that Reagan wasn't to be messed with. Walker is trying to hide his lack of foreign policy know-how behind his toughness against unions. But voters know there's a big difference between dealing with bloodthirsty jihadists and peaceful American protesters. If he secures the nomination, Walker's shortcomings will be quickly exposed in debates with the likely Democratic candidate, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Walker cannot win if he becomes merely the favorite of the conservative base. He must also show the nation he is ready to take on the job of commander-in-chief. From Steve Chapman at the Chicago Tribune, our irrational insanity laws. When a Texas jury rejected Eddie Ray Ruth's insanity defense and convicted him last week of murdering American sniper Chris Kyle and his friend Chad Littlefield, it raised an important question, said Steve Chapman. If this guy isn't crazy, who is? Routh was in and out of psychiatric hospitals after being discharged from the Marines in 2010 and told doctors that a giant tapeworm was tormenting him. While Kyle was traveling with Routh to the gun range where the murders took place, Routh behaved so strangely that Kyle texted Littlefield, "This dude is straight up nuts." Despite that evidence, Routh was classified as sane in the eyes of the law. In Texas and other states, defense attorneys faced almost insurmountable hurdles to prove their clients can't judge right from wrong. This isn't a bug in our justice system, it's a feature. Many Americans simply can't accept that some people are not responsible for their crimes because their minds are defective. Obviously, killers like Routh need to be kept off the streets, preferably in a mental institution. But pretending that such defendants can behave as rationally as the rest of us is straight up nuts. In a column from Germany, from Christina Huckelnbroich, at Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, how to stop our measles outbreak. The measles outbreak ravaging Berlin is deadly proof that it's time to make immunization mandatory, said Christina Huckelnbroich. The virus resurfaced here last fall, apparently brought by refugees from Bosnia-Herzegovina, and in a few months it has sickened some 600 people. One child, an infant too young to be immunized, has died from the disease, and up to 30 Berliners a day are being infected. Health Minister Hermann Grohe is now saying timidly that discussing mandatory vaccination should not be taboo. He's being far too hesitant. We must require vaccinations for all children in public child care or public schools. It won't be terribly difficult to implement. After all, most Germans who don't vaccinate are philosophically opposed to the practice or frightened of the risks, but rather have forgotten to take their children to be immunized. It's simply intolerable that a small child should be put at risk of death through the forgetfulness of other parents. Every German has the duty to protect the vulnerable. Would a mandate work? The evidence is there to be seen in the U.S., where some states require all school-age children to be vaccinated, while others allow parents to opt out. Guess which states are having outbreaks and which are healthy. Our in-depth article this week is titled, The Quietest Town in America. Locals here don't mind the lack of Wi-Fi or cell service, said Michael Gaynor. It's the newcomers they don't like. Monique Grimes had just moved to St. Petersburg, Florida for a new job when the syndrome started. On the third morning there, she woke up with a harsh thumping in her chest. Within hours, it felt as if someone had tied a thick rubber band around her head. Then came nausea, fatigue, ringing in her left ear, an onslaught of maladies all at once, and she had no idea why. I was trying to come up with every excuse in the world for what was happening to me, she says. Moving is stressful, but the symptoms just kept piling on. It was 2012, and Grimes had gone to Florida to be a speaker for a public policy group. But a week or two into the job, whatever was afflicting her still wasn't abating. And before long, her speech became so jumbled that she couldn't form a complete sentence in front of an audience. She saw an internist, a neurologist, then a psychiatrist, and still had no explanation. If we can't test it, one said, it doesn't exist. Grimes started poking around online and soon remembered reading an article about the potentially deleterious health effects of the new smart electricity meters that were rolling out across the country. The devices send customers' usage data back to the utility over wireless signals. Did her building have them? She went outside to inspect the place and found no fewer than 17 of the meters strapped to the side of the building. Grimes went back online and found tale after tale of people from all over the world getting sick from the devices. And it wasn't just smart meters. It turned out there was a whole community of people out there who call themselves electrosensitives and said they were suffering because of the electromagnetic frequencies that radiate wirelessly from cell phones, Wi-Fi networks, radio waves, and virtually every other modern technology that the rest of society now thinks of as indispensable. The affliction has been dubbed electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or EHS, and it involves a textbook's worth of ailments: headaches, nausea, insomnia, chest pains, disorientation, digestive difficulties, and so on. Mainstream medicine doesn't recognize the syndrome, but the symptoms described everything Grimes was experiencing. She went back to her doctors with her newfound evidence of EHS, relieved to have sorted out the mystery, but she got no sympathy. As she puts it, they look at you like you have three heads. Grimes moved to a new building, then another, and six more times, but at each turn, a smart meter rollout wasn't far behind. That's when she heard about a little town called Green Bank, West Virginia. In Green Bank, you can't make a call on your cell phone, and you can't text on it either. Wireless internet is outlawed, as is Bluetooth. It's a pre-modern place by design, devoid of the gadgets and technologies that define life today. And thanks to Uncle Sam, it will stay that way. The town is part of a federally mandated zone where a government high-tech facility's needs come first. Wireless signals are verboten. In electromagnetic terms, it's one of the quietest places on Earth, blanketed by the kind of silence that's golden to electrosensitives like Grimes. And as she discovered, it's become a refuge for them. Over the last few years, electrosensitives have flocked to the tech-free idyll, taking shelter beside cows and farms and fellow sufferers. Up here, no one would look at them as if they had three heads. Well, except for the locals, that is. The reason for all the peace and quiet in town is visible the moment you arrive. It's the Robert C. Byrd Telescope, a gleaming white 485-foot-tall behemoth of a dish that looms over tiny Green Bank, population 143. There's only one road into town, about 4 hours from Washington, D.C. The way there snakes through the Allegheny Mountains. Each town you pass through smaller than the previous, as the bars on your cell phone fall like dominoes and the scan functions on the radio ceases to work. The valley opens to cattle farms and old wooden barns, a post office and a library, a bank and Henry's Quick Stop, a combination gas station, convenience store, rustic interior decor shop that houses Green Bank's nearest approximation to a sit-down restaurant. Across the street, the Dollar General was a lifesaver when it opened 5 years ago. Before that, the closest grocery store was in Marlinton, 26 miles down the road. At the northern end of town is the other visible curiosity in Green Bank besides the telescope, a rusted payphone. If you're not from there, it's ostensibly the only way to reach the rest of the world. Sometimes you get people passing through who get aggravated they can't get a signal, says Bob Irvine, owner of Trent's General Store. But just about anybody will let you use their home phone. Rising above it all is the Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope, a.k.a. the GBT. It's the largest of its kind in the world and one of nine in Green Bank, all of them government-owned and operated by the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, NRAO. The telescopes aren't ocular ones, the kind you're probably thinking of. They're radio telescopes. So instead of putting your eye to the apparatus and looking for distant stars, you listen for them. The patterns of electromagnetic radiation coming off a planet or other celestial bodies reveal entirely different things from what's visible to the eye, and even allow scientists to study regions of space where light can't reach. In recent years, the telescopes have been used to track NASA's Cassini probe to Saturn's moon and to examine Mercury's molten core. Obscure as the work may sound, there is a long line of astronomers all over the world who want to use the GBT, a telescope so sensitive that it can pick up the energy equivalent of a single snowflake hitting the ground. These scientists swamp the NRAO with their research proposals. The observatory is four times oversubscribed. So why does such a sensitive listening tool need total technological silence to operate? A little history helps explain. In 1932, when Bell Labs was installing phone systems across the U.S., its technicians kept hearing static over the transmissions. The company hired an electrical engineer to find the source, and he discovered that all the noise was the Milky Way galaxy itself, says Mike Holstein, the telescope's business manager, with a hint of awe in his voice. 2 decades later, the federal government decided the country should invest in listening to the far reaches of the galaxy and needed its own radio telescope to do so. The question was where to put it. Because even a basic AM radio transmission is enough to overpower faint readings from outer space, the only place for such a listening post was the hinterlands. Enter Green Bank. Surrounded by the Alleghenies, and thus buffered from outside frequencies, the rural town had little established industry, or potential for one. That meant the telescope wouldn't have to deal with a population influx later. Plus, Green Bank sat on the 38th parallel, with an ideal view of the Milky Way. In 1958, the Federal Communications Commission established the 13,000-square-mile National Radio Quiet Zone, a one-of-a-kind area encompassing Green Bank where, to this day, electromagnetic silence is enforced every hour of every day. The strictest rules are found within the 10 square miles immediately surrounding Green Bank, where most forms of modern communication, that is, cell phones and Wi-Fi, are banned under state law. Residents are allowed to use landline phones and wired internet, but it is slow, in the words of one Green Banker. The quiet zone is a vast place, much of it made up of national parks and empty space, the whole thing roughly the size of Maryland. But lately, because of how much its way of life has diverged from the rest of America's and whom that's attracted to the place, the little town of Greenbank has come to feel smaller than ever. In 2007, Diane and Bert Hsu became some of the first electrosensitives to move to Greenbank. Then came Jennifer Wood, once an architect working for the University of Hawaii, and Monique Grimes. One after another, the electrosensitives rolled into Greenbank until there were roughly two dozen, no small number for a 143-person town. For many, the journey there was long and frustrating. Diane Hsu had identified the cell phone tower near her home in Iowa as the culprit of her woes back in 2003. But when she complained to company and government officials, she couldn't get any traction. She spent months living in a Faraday cage, a wood-framed box with metal meshing that blocked out cell signals. She and Bert drove thousands of miles across the U.S. looking for a safe place to stay and spent time with relatives in Sweden, the first country to recognize electromagnetic hypersensitivity as a disability. It was a national park ranger in North Carolina who told Hsu about Greenbank, and she tried out the place while living in her car behind Henry's Quick Shop. The transition wasn't easy. Coming to Greenbank was a culture shock, she says. If you want to have a Starbucks and shopping malls, you won't survive here. But the Hsus didn't feel they had a lot of choice, given how much better they felt inside the quiet zone. The couple found an unfinished home and sold half of their Iowa farm to buy, furnish, and rewire it. It wasn't long before Diane Hsu became the de facto electrosensitive gatekeeper of Greenbank. Fellow sufferers heard about her and spread the word, and soon she was letting visitors stay in her home when they came to try out the place for themselves. Jennifer Wood, the former architect, who said her own husband didn't believe her disease was real, remembers what it was like to walk into the Hsu's home and be welcomed by a handful of other electrosensitives. It was just like family, Wood says. But not everyone in Greenbank was so keen to meet the new neighbors. There have been some rough spots in dealing with the other members of the community, says the very diplomatic Sheriff David Jones, whose Pocahontas County Department has been called in several times to mediate disputes between old-timers and newcomers. They want everybody in the stores and restaurants to change their lighting or turn their lights off when they're there, which creates some issues. The clash may ultimately be settled by a force outside Greenbanker's control, the fate of the telescope. It's funded entirely by the National Science Foundation, and 2 years ago, in a wave of belt-tightening across the federal government, a committee recommended shutting down the campus. If the observatory can't find outside funding, it could close by 2017. Whatever happens, Grimes is pretty convinced that future generations will see the folly of iPhones and laptops, just like past ones did asbestos and cigarettes. As one sympathetic doctor told her, "You were just born 100 years before your time," or after, her husband Tom quips, knowing there's a pretty decent chance they're sitting in the last quiet place on Earth. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Washington Magazine. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The Star Trek actor who learned to love the alien. Leonard Nimoy, 1931 to 2015. When Leonard Nimoy was approached in 1966 about a role in the new TV series called Star Trek, he reacted with a cool, dispassionate, and almost Vulcan logic. The chance of this becoming anything meaningful was slim, the actor recalled, I really didn't give it a lot of thought. But Nimoy won the part of the pointy-eared half-human, half-Vulcan Spock and quickly became a cultural icon. Mountains of fan mail arrived addressed to Mr. Spock, Hollywood, California. Star Trek fans greeted Nimoy with Spock's Vulcan salute, palm outstretched, middle and ring finger pushed apart, wherever he went. Initially, Nimoy resented his loss of identity. His first autobiography, published in 1975, was titled, I Am Not Spock. But over time, he came to accept his status as a sci-fi hero. His second memoir, published in 1995, was called, I Am Spock. If someone said, you can have the choice of being any other TV character ever played, he wrote, I would choose Spock. I like him. I admire him. I respect him. Born in Boston to Ukrainian Jewish immigrants, Nimoy grew up in a Yiddish-speaking household, said the Washington Post. During Orthodox Jewish services, he saw worshipers praying with their fingers parted in the middle, which later became the inspiration for the Vulcan salute. Rejecting his parents' pleas to pursue a stable career, learn to play the accordion, his father told him. You can always make it a living with an accordion. Nimoy abandoned a scholarship at Boston College to seek a career in Hollywood. After a few years of scratching around for parts and a short spell in the Army, he was cast in Star Trek. The cool rationality of Nimoy's Spock was the perfect foil to the histrionics of William Shatner's Captain Kirk, the emotive commander of the starship Enterprise, said the Wall Street Journal. Spock's hyperlogical demeanor was made more complex by a brand of ethics summed up by his catchphrase, live long and prosper. Star Trek was canceled after 3 years because of low ratings, said the Los Angeles Times. But by then, Nimoy was famous. After 2 years on the Mission Impossible TV series, Nimoy became something of a Renaissance man, studying photography at the University of California, writing 7 books of poetry, and creating a comic book series with science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. In 1979, Nimoy returned to play Spock in the rather leaden Star Trek The Motion Picture, said The Guardian. He reprised the role in 5 further movies and later played an older version of Spock in the successful 2009 Star Trek movie reboot. As well as releasing a string of terribly reviewed music albums, Nimoy established himself as a successful and varied director, helming 2 of the Star Trek movies and the 1987 box office hit 3 Men and a Baby. But he knew he would always be remembered as Spock. Nimoy often joked about the irony of his success, given his immigrant parents. They were aliens and then became citizens, he said. I was born in Boston a citizen, and then I went to Hollywood and became an alien. On the health and science page, preventing peanut allergies. Peanut allergies are on the rise, but a new study suggests that many cases can be prevented by exposing at-risk infants to peanut products rather than strictly avoiding them. Turning conventional wisdom on its head, scientists at King's College London found that infants between 4 and 11 months old who were given 6 grams of peanut protein on a weekly basis were 80% less likely to develop an allergy by age 5 than children who were not exposed. The results suggest that early exposure enables children to build a tolerance to peanuts before they develop an abnormal reaction to them. Longstanding guidelines advising parents to omit peanuts from the diets of high-risk children, generally those who have a family history or show signs of other food allergies, were retracted in 2008 because of a lack of evidence. But the American Academy of Pediatrics has yet to issue new recommendations, even though peanut allergies have quadrupled in the U.S. over the past 18 years. The findings are robust, lead researcher Gideon Lack tells WashingtonPost.com, and suggests that under a doctor's supervision, at-risk kids should be encouraged to eat peanuts regularly. The health scare of the week, anger linked to heart attacks. The fury that fuels road rage, heated family arguments, or work-related disputes can do more than take a toll on people's quality of life. New research suggests that such bouts of extreme anger may also increase the risk of having a heart attack. Scientists in Australia surveyed more than 300 heart attack patients about their feelings of anger prior to the hospitalization. They found that the risk of a heart attack within 2 hours of experience intense anger was 8.5 times higher than normal. Although the chance that one temper tantrum will trigger a heart attack remains low, such emotions have been shown to narrow blood vessels, promote the formation of blood clots, and increase blood pressure, suggesting that a patient's psychological state should be considered alongside other risk factors such as smoking or high cholesterol. People who are prone to high level of angers, study leader Thomas Buckley tells the Sydney Morning Herald, need to know their triggers and look for the warning signs. On the Talking Points page, the GOP struggling to govern. A majority in Congress is a terrible thing to waste, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But only 2 months into their largest majority since the 1920s, Republicans are well on their way. Party leaders thought they could overturn President Obama's executive action on immigration by using funding for the Department of Homeland Security as leverage. Not only was this harebrained scheme always doomed to failure, their proposed bill lacked the 60 votes required to pass the Senate, but it also sparked a damaging inter-party war. When House Speaker John Boehner tried to pass a 3-week funding extension last Friday, a revolt by 52 House Republicans meant he had to settle for a 1-week extension instead. And even that required Democratic support to pass. The no-compromise crowd finally bowed to the inevitable on Tuesday, passing a bill with no immigration riders that will fund the department through September. But the preceding fiasco raises the question of whether House Republicans can even function as a majority. Republicans were pointing a gun at their own head, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Had they followed through on their threat to defund Homeland Security, they would have been blamed for endangering American lives and left holding the bag for Obama's disastrous policies. Besides, the conservative-leaning Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals will rule on Obama's executive action on immigration in the next few weeks. Had the Republicans waited it out, the courts might have rescued them from their ill-fated DHS strategy. The GOP's powerful right flank isn't interested in waiting, said Gail Collins in the New York Times. Unlike the party leadership, the Tea Party caucus is almost exclusively focused on looking tough for voters back home. With these guys ready to rebel, Boehner simply didn't have the numbers to govern effectively. Still to come, raising the debt ceiling and passing a budget. Recent polls suggest the public is ready to get behind the Republicans on virtually every major issue, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. The problem is, while voters say they trust the GOP to handle most issues, they also see the party as too extreme and intolerant, exactly the qualities being highlighted in these internecine battles. Republicans desperately need to take the spotlight off themselves. Making yourself the story is very rarely a winning strategy in politics. And a few notes here. A record 1,826 billionaires made this year's Forbes richest list, with an aggregate net worth of $7.05 trillion, up from $6.4 trillion last year. The list includes 290 newcomers, 71 of whom are from China. The list also includes a record 46 billionaires under age 40. The Labrador Retriever has been ranked by the American Kennel Club as the most popular dog breed in the United States for the 24th year running. The German Shepherd and Golden Retriever took second and third place, while the Bulldog scored fourth place for the first time ever. More than 5 million American adults say they've used online dating sites in the past 30 days, double the number 5 years ago. Half were between the ages of 18 and 34. 12% report being currently married. The poll watch, 38% of Americans view Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu favorably, including 53% of Republicans and 28% of Democrats. 27% of Americans hold an unfavorable view of Netanyahu, and 23% say they have never heard of him. We'll finish with two quotes today. The first comes from our first president, George Washington. He says, "Human happiness and moral duty are inseparably connected." The second is from Larry King, quoted in FastCompany.com. "I never learned anything while I was talking." And I have to wonder if that applies to reading out loud on the radio. I'll have to think about that. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.